From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Today in British Parliament there will be a debate on the Iraqi crisis, and not only the Labour Party is divided, but also the right-wing Tory Party is divided on this, and the dissidents of the Tory Party want Mr. Blair to prove that Iraq is a direct threat to the UK before they sanction anything about war.
Today, Dilip Hero, Iraq in the Eye of the Storm, and filmmaker John Pilger's Paying the Price, Killing the Children of Iraq. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Pentagon has quietly told the White House and Congress that war in Iraq will likely cost at least $85 billion. This is more than twice what the Bush administration has been claiming publicly. The Los Angeles Times reports the final cost could rise further. The State Department plans to ask Congress for up to $18 billion to give to allies who back the U.S. in war. And Turkey is already set to receive $15 billion in aid from the U.S. in return for allowing the U.S. to station up to 60,000 troops on Turkish soil. Last year, former White House economic adviser Lawrence Lindsay was fired in part because he estimated war would cost up to $200 billion. The rising costs of the war come as the U.S. Army's top general says the Pentagon will need to station several hundred thousand U.S. troops in a post-war Iraq. Meanwhile, USA Today is reporting that state and local governments here are now borrowing money at a rate not seen since the 1950s. Borrowing to cover deficits has increased by 3.5 times in just the past 3 years. This according to a new analysis by USA Today. Back in Iraq, U.S. warplanes bombed 5 missile sites in northern and southern Iraq yesterday in the most extensive attack since November. The strikes come as part of the U.S.-British enforcement of the so-called no-fly zones, which have never been endorsed by the United Nations. The White House said yesterday Saddam Hussein and other Iraqi leaders would be legitimate targets for U.S. military forces in a war. Meanwhile, Saddam Hussein vowed to stay in Iraq and not go into exile. The New York Times reports that U.S. intelligence officials have identified more than 2,000 members of the Iraqi elite, including some to be captured as possible war criminals and many more that the U.S. military will try to turn against Saddam Hussein. In a major address tonight, George Bush is expected to outline his post-war vision for Iraq. He will also emphasize a broader U.S. campaign, which the administration has dubbed, quote, the battle for the future of the Muslim world. In Thailand, nearly 1,000 people have been killed and almost 9,000 have been arrested since February 1st when the government began a major crackdown on illegal drugs. Human rights groups say the government has implemented a shoot-to-kill policy to target drug users. Officials blame inter-gang warfare as the reason for the high number of deaths. The government has also compiled a blacklist of over 45,000 suspected drug users, all of whom have been ordered to report to the government. In Washington, the Supreme Court ruled yesterday that an African-American on death row in Texas should get another chance to have his sentence overturned because of alleged racial bias at his 1986 murder trial. The court warned federal courts against prematurely limiting the appeals of state prisoners. Justice Clarence Thomas cast the lone dissenting decision. In TV news, MSNBC has canceled talk show host Phil Donahue's nightly broadcast, which had been on the air since the summer. In Alabama, a man looking for work opened fire at a temporary employment agency. 4 fellow job seekers were killed, a 5th person injured. In Santa Fe, New Mexico, the city council is set to vote today on a law that would require every company in the city with 10 or more employees to raise the minimum hourly wages to $8.50 by this summer. The Treasury Department has fined a 74-year-old award-winning cyclist $8,000 for going on a biking tour of Cuba, breaking the U.S. embargo of the island. According to the Guardian of London, the number of Americans fined for traveling to Cuba has quadrupled since George Bush took office. The Treasury Department is also targeting groups that organize and promote trips to Cuba. In Israel, the extreme right-wing party National Union has joined Prime Minister Ariel Sharon's coalition. Agence France-Presse reports this will likely cripple any chance that Israel will meet the international peace demands. A new report by the National Academy of Sciences charges the Bush administration has failed to adequately fund research on global warming and is attempting to rehash questions that have already been answered. The New York Times is reporting that radio programmers are planning to adjust their playlists to become more patriotic if the U.S. attacks Iraq. A vice president of ABC Radio said playlists will likely soon include songs like America the Beautiful by Ray Charles, God Bless the USA by Lee Greenwood, and Born in the USA by Bruce Springsteen. Meanwhile, over 40 musicians and bands have co-signed a full-page ad in the New York Times that reads, "War on Iraq is wrong and we know it. Don't let Bush, Cheney, and Rumsfeld drown out the voices of reasons." The artists include Missy Elliott, Ani DeFranco, Steve Earle, and Sonic Youth. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. British Prime Minister Tony Blair tonight faces what the London Guardian calls the most dangerous challenge yet to Blair's six-year reign. Parliament is set to vote on Blair's aggressive policy against Iraq. Members of Parliament from Blair's own Labour Party are under orders to support the government, and the government is expected to win. But backbench organizers say over 150 MPs are prepared to vote against Blair. It would be by far the largest revolt of the Blair era. Anti-war sentiment is very strong in Britain. On February 15th, over a million people marched in London, a city of only 7 million people. And several major British newspapers and tabloids are outspoken against the war. Today, we're joined in our Firehouse studios by Dilip Hero, a Middle East analyst based in London. He's author of more than a dozen books on the Middle East, writes regularly for the London Observer and Guardian as a frequent commentator on the BBC. But Dilip Hero's influence is extending to the other side of the Atlantic. He regularly contributes to The Washington Post, CNN, and The Nation. This week, in an opinion piece called Not So Fast, Washington Post columnist William Raspberry writes, "This is hard. Soon after very nearly swooning after Colin Powell's report to the United Nations Security Council, I find myself thinking the once unthinkable. I don't believe him. It's not that I think the Secretary of State, the one member of the president's inner circle I thought we could count on to be straight with us in Iraq, is lying, but I'm starting to think that his interpretation of facts and circumstances assumes so many things and ignores so many others that it comes to the same thing. Whence my change of heart? For one thing, I've had time to digest that tour de force performance of earlier this month. For another, I've been listening and reading, particularly Dilip Hero's book, Iraq in the Eye of the Storm. And finally, I found it impossible to see how Powell's allegations and speculation, even if they are all true, lead so ineluctably to war." Well, we're joined right now by Dilip Hero, author of In the Eye of the Storm. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Iraq in the Eye of the Storm, a report from the inside by one of world's leading authorities on the Middle East. Welcome.
Thank you.
Why don't we start with what's happening tonight in the British Parliament and how significant it is?
It's very significant. It's not just a question that the ruling Labour Party is divided, but even the right-wing Tory party is divided. In fact, the dissidents within the Tory party wrote a letter to their leader, Mr. Duncan Smith, in which they put four conditions. They said, number one, Mr. Blair must prove that Iraq is the direct threat to the United Kingdom, number one. Number two, there should be full debate in Parliament and a motion passed by majority before British troops are ordered to go into action. Number three, UN Security Council must authorize force. And number four, that it should be stated that force is the last resort. Now, these are conditions not by left-wing, loony left-wing Labour MPs. These are the conditions being given by the Tory backbenchers, in one of whom is actually an ex-foreign secretary.
Can you talk about Iraq and also Iran right now and how Iran plays into this? I was listening to Wolf Blitzer interview the Iranian ambassador, and he asked him if he was for the attack on Iraq. By the way, he said no. And he said, given that Saddam Hussein gassed Iranian soldiers, Wolf Blitzer didn't mention that the U.S. provided the coordinates and the intelligence for that gassing. But can you talk about that?
Absolutely. I think it's very interesting, you know, that to say now that Saddam invaded Iraq, an aggressor, now, when actually Saddam did this in September 1980, the U.S. did nothing. You know, the U.S. at the U.N. Security Council, from the day one of the Iraqi attack on Iran, always treated both sides, the attacker and the victim, as equals. They said to them, stop fighting, stop fighting, stop fighting. You know, and that is, and now, after 23 years, these guys have woken up. Oh, he invaded Iraq first. You know, so this is, you know, absolute example of amnesia and then pulling out things, you know, a quarter century after they've happened. Now, at present, the Iranian position is, to put it mildly, ambivalent. After all, they were, you know, at war with Iraq for 8 years. And so they are saying, of course, we would like a regime change. By the way, the word regime change was used by the Iranians in 1982. And when they said, we'll stop fighting if Saddam is replaced, and you know what happened? The next week, Saddam had 1.5 million people in the streets shouting, Saddam, Saddam, Saddam. So I think that in that sense, the Iranians, you know, would like him to go. Many countries would like him to go. The question is how it's to be done. And even the pro-Iranian Iraqi group, which is based in Tehran, if it is, you know, participating in the opposition deliberations, they keep saying that once he's overthrown, then America should go away. We will settle everything on our own. That seems to me rather very unrealistic. You know, you don't expect the country to invest the amount of money you talked about, you know, $85 billion, et cetera, and then just walk away. So the Iranians are a bit confused in this case. At the same time, they also know that they are next. In fact, you know, John Bolton in Israel, he said, after we finish with Iraq, we're going to go into Iran, Syria, and North Korea.
I'm also looking at this report from The Hague, opening a suit against the United States at the World Court. Iran asserted on Monday that Washington violated a treaty with Tehran by siding with Baghdad during the Iran-Iraq War of the 1980s and firing on three of its oil platforms in the Gulf.
Yeah, absolutely. This had been going on. See, what's interesting is that what happened in the Iran-Iraq War actually is having, shall I say, come back. You know, we can see, you know, the directive that President Reagan wrote in November 1983, which is still classified, but we know the contents roughly, in which it said that defeat of Iraq will be defeat of the Western world. These are roughly his words. And then in 1987, quite openly, the USA opened a second front against Iran in the Persian Gulf. You know, there were so many of these Navy ships and so on and so forth. And that is when, you know, Iran had to step back. And, of course, the war came to an end in August 1988. And, by the way, the other thing that you mentioned, I'm sorry to bring this up, you said more than 1 million people in this anti-war protest. And, I'm sorry, the figure is 1.5 million. And I was one of the 1.5 million. You know, if you know London, I can tell you, just to give you an idea, if you know Hyde Park If you have been to London, of course, your listeners or viewers, and the Hyde Park rally started at 2 p.m., finished 5:15. I was at the rally, and we walked from there, and we were at the Green Park Tube Station, and the people were still going to the place where the rally had finished. They had started, starting point at 12:30 p.m. At 5:45, people were still marching to go to the place where the rally had finished. So 1.5 million people.
So why, though it will be the biggest opposition vote against Blair, will he prevail tonight?
I think, you see, there's a certain difference here. Of course, you know, the Labour MPs, there's some kind of discipline and loyalty. But at the same time, I have to say, I mean, where I live in London, I have my MP, and he actually is the chair of the Parliamentary Labour Party. It's Clive Soley. And for the first time, I took the trouble to send him fax, telling him, first of all, this book is coming out in London in about a week's time. Secondly, I said to him, I hope Labour MPs will exercise their right to change their leader if they find that he or she is out of step with public opinion. You know, which means, of course, as you know, the parliamentary system is such that if Labour MPs get together and they say, Mr. Blair, you are no longer our leader, say somebody else is. This is what happened to Margaret Thatcher when she was Prime Minister. You know, overnight she was thrown out by the Tory MPs. So it can be done. It might still happen. And if he has any memory, in 1956, there was a Tory Prime Minister, Anthony Eden, and he locked horns with another Arab leader, Mr. Nasser, whom he used to call Hitler. And you know what happened to Mr. Anthony Eden? You know, thrown on the rubbish bin of history.
We're talking to Dilip Piro. He is the author of Iraq in the Eye of the Storm. Bush is intending to outline his post-war vision for Iraq tonight, an address to the American Enterprise Institute, in which he is expected to showcase the administration's belief that Saddam Hussein's overthrow will be a significant step toward broad democratic change in the Arab world. Your response?
I mean, let me be very... let's say you have got friends, okay? Let's say you have got friends, and you know democracy is good, and they are not democratic. And you've got some enemies who are also not democratic. Now, who would you start to sell your idea of democracy? To the friends. Because they listen to you. You know, Egypt is a friend of USA. Saudi Arabia is a friend of USA. Jordan is a friend of USA. So if this wonderful thing called democracy is a good thing, why doesn't Bush and companies, you know, say, Mr. Mubarak, this is a very nice medicine. You should take it 3 times a day. It will give you good health. You know, democracy is wonderful. Now, why not to start with people who are your friends and give them democracy? Secondly, democracy is a very big thing. You know, it's a change of laws and elections and political parties, you know, and some people don't. Transition is difficult. Look at old Eastern Europe. They've got problems. So, very simple. If I were George W. Bush, I have a meeting with the leader of Qatar or leader of Saudi Arabia. I said to them, you know, why don't you hold opinion polls in your country and publish them? Publish them. Simple. You know, in Turkey, you talked about Turkey earlier, $15 billion. 83% of Turks are against giving USA the right to use the air bases. Forget about participating in the war. Now, how would it be if 83% people in the USA are against war, but the gentleman sitting in the White House wants to go around and practice his pistol shooting? How would it be? It's unthinkable, which means that the USA administration is not respecting the democratic rights of Turkish people. I mean, so this whole thing about democracy, let's start small. And you know, Saudi Arabia, the Interior Ministry of Saudi Arabia did hold a public opinion poll in October of last 2001 when Afghanistan war started. And you know what they found? 95% of Saudi citizens in the age group of 28 to 41 agreed with the policies of bin Laden. That is, they wanted the U.S. troops out of Saudi Arabia. Of course, this figure was not published.
What about the fact, from your perspective, that you have 15 of the 19 hijackers from Saudi Arabia? You have one scandal after another with the Saudi embassy in Washington, from giving money to those who were related to the hijackers to the most recent, giving a visa, getting someone back into Saudi Arabia from the United States who the FBI wanted questioned here, yet the U.S. government is not raising a peep.
Precisely. You know, and you know what's happened since then? It's wonderful. Of course, what you said, William Raspberry, of course, you know, he takes the trouble to have different viewpoints, read different things. But, you know, already the poll that I have seen, people, majority of people in USA believe that half of the hijackers came from Iraq. I mean, nobody came from Iraq. You know, 15 out of 19, and of course one was from Lebanon, one was from the UAE, one was from Yemen, but nobody came from Iraq. And that is, shall I say, the wonder. I mean, we are really living in Orwellian world. You know, and because if you pump out these things constantly, then people believe. Take simple things. You know, of course, this reference of Mr. Raspberry to Mr. Powell's presentation. You know, Mr. Powell said, this particular place in Iraqi Kurdistan, this is a poison factory. You know, next week the journalists went there and they found this was a dump. Secondly, take the simple thing. That little enclave is within the area which is controlled by the pro-American Patriotic Union of Kurdistan. There are only 600 guerrillas, or insurgents, and that PUK has 13,000 soldiers, and they have the backing of the USA. So why not to go ahead and just wipe them out? I mean, 600 insurgents, and you can cut off their supplies of water, supply of electricity. You know. And thirdly, and this is the most, I'm sorry to say, amusing part. This gentleman called Abu Musab Zarqawi, you know, he is the connection between Al-Qaeda and Ansari Islam and the bad guy in Baghdad.
Powell saying this was the Al-Qaeda link to Saddam Hussein.
Yeah, this is Abu Zarqawi. Among the things Abu Zarqawi is supposed to have done, he went to Baghdad for medical treatment. Oh, my God. I mean, the last place in the world you want to go for medical treatment is Baghdad because they don't even have enough aspirins to go around. You know, what I'm saying is that instead of producing these wonderful intelligence things, intercepts, satellite pictures, before you start thinking about that, use this little thing in your head. Use common sense. You know, one other thing. You know, Tariq Aziz, the deputy prime minister, number two man in Iraq, his real name is Mikhail Yahuna. Look up page 39 of my Dictionary of the Middle East. And he is a Chaldean Catholic Christian. You know, he had a meeting with the Pope the other day. Now, if I were, misunderstand me. If I were a Bin Laden, for me, all Christians are crusaders. All Christians are crusaders. So how am I going to cooperate with the regime whose number two man is a crusader, is a Christian? I mean, it's unthinkable. So to start beating all kinds of things and looking under the carpets and so on and so forth, and there's a connection. Tell me something else. You know, right now as we speak, in Baghdad, there is an organization called Mujahideen-e-Khalq Organization of Iran. And that organization is on the State Department terrorist list since October 97, right? That spokesman of theirs, Mr. Soleimani, wrote a letter to the Financial Times published last Friday, the 21st of February, his name, his address in Baghdad. Now, if you are Mr. Bush, if you are Ms. Rice, you want to show Saddam helping terrorists, just say, listen, that Mujahideen-e-Khalq organization has been there since 87. It is a banned organization. So why do you have to go around, look up the medical card of Abu Zarqawi and have these fancy satellite pictures? Just blame Saddam for having Mujahideen-e-Khalq organization in Baghdad, which is supported by the government. So you might say, why not? Why? Because those guys are against the mullahs in Iran. That's why. So go all over the world and, you know, have these fancy things, have Mr. CIA chief sitting next to Mr. Powell so that, you know, he's a backup guy. But you're wasting their time. You know, And I have been to Baghdad. I have seen that office of Mujahideen al-Khalq. You know where the office is? Just across the street is the Hotel Swan Lake. And on the other side is the office of Mujahideen al-Khalq organization. They have a lot of antennas up there, and I know what they are. And, of course, when I was in midtown Baghdad, you know, they can ask anybody, please tell me.
You're saying they won't go after them because they don't want to antagonize the mullahs of Iran?
No, the other way around. Because they are against the mullahs in Iran, therefore they're good guys. I mean, see, this is so obvious, and everybody knows. And the other thing, okay, I don't want to sort of. There are so many U.S. journalists from Time, from LA Times, from Post, from Boston Globe. They have been there for at least 6, 7, 8 since November. I don't think any of them has bothered to go to the Hotel Swan Lake. Well, I have been. I mean, I have gone past, and I went with a minder, and I said, "Excuse me, Mustafa, okay, pseudonym, okay. What are these? I say, excuse me. What are these? What is? Oh, this is the government office. This is the office of Mujahideen Khalq of Iran. They have been there since 1986, and they have constant. They attack the Iranian at the Iranian border, and they have 6,000 soldiers, and they are backed officially by the Iraqi government. So, if you really have to say Saddam is helping the terrorists. My God, why do you have to go around looking in little enclave somewhere in Kurdistan with your, you know, big satellite pictures? It's there. It's in midtown Baghdad.
We only have 30 seconds to go. The quote tonight of what George Bush will be putting out in his address, talking about the battle for the future of the Muslim world to justify the U.S. attack.
I'm sorry, I can't help, but, you know, this is absolute George Orwell. George, you know, Orwell, we live in Orwell, you know, there was a poll done in December by International Herald Tribune along with the Pew Research, you know, in the USA, which is partly run by Ms. Albright. And they found in Egypt only 6% of the people have a positive view of America. In Pakistan, only 11% have a view of Pakistan. Now, and as you know, day before yesterday, there was an interview in the Times with Mr. Brahimi, who is the UN diplomat sitting in Kabul, and his words are, his words, not my words, I'm quoting him, to say, if there's attack on Iraq, there will be a lot of anti-American feeling in Pakistan, which will spill over. And do you know, I know it for a fact, that there is today in Afghanistan, Al-Qaeda is running its own radio station. Fact. Fact. So if Mr. Bush is going to attack Iraq, whether it's singly or by bribing some Security Council members, doesn't matter which way, it is going not only to reduce terrorism, it will increase terrorism. You know, it is as if I was a general. I have one front here, and which I haven't pacified, because what happened in Bali, what happened in Mombasa, you know, that guys keep coming at me, and then I am going to open another front. And if you are commander-in-chief, what will you do to me?
Fire you.
And if, so if Bush had another commander-in-chief and he behaved this way, he'll be out on his ear. I hope that, you know, the U.S. public will act as the commander-in-chief.
Do you think it's possible to stop the invasion?
Why not? This is not an act of nature, you know. I mean, it's a human decision.
On that note, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Dilip Hero. He is author of Iraq in the Eye of the Storm. It's published by Nation Books. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You are listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, John Pilger's Paying the Price, Killing the Children of Iraq. Stay with us. What you know about it? Come on.
Destiny's day, I wanna feel.
You are listening to Democracy Now!, Breaking the Sound Barrier. I'm Amy Goodman. A recent edition of the London Mirror showed a picture of Tony Blair with blood on his hands. That was the headline for a recent cover story in the London Mirror, Blood on His Hands. The cover depicted a picture of Tony Blair, yes, you guessed it, with bloody hands. The rest of the cover reads, John Pilger, his most damning verdict of Tony Blair. Pilger's an acclaimed Australian journalist and filmmaker based in Britain. He begins his column, William Russell, the great correspondent who reported the carnage of imperial wars, may have first used the expression on his hands to describe impeccable politicians who at a safe distance order the mass killing of ordinary people. In my experience, on his hands applies especially to those modern political leaders, John Pilger writes, who have had no personal experience of war, like George W. Bush, who managed not to serve in Vietnam, and the effete Tony Blair. There is about them the essential cowardice of the man who causes death and suffering not by his own hand, but through a chain of command that affirms his authority. In 1946, the judges at Nuremberg, who tried the Nazi leaders for war crimes, left no doubt about what they regarded as the gravest crimes against humanity. The most serious was unprovoked invasion of a sovereign state that offered no threat to one's homeland. Then there was the murder of civilians, for which responsibility rested with the highest authority. Blair is about to commit both crimes. That, again, from a recent column of John Pilger in the London Mirror. Well, today we're going to hear an excerpt of John Pilger's documentary that he did on Iraq, Paying the Price, Killing the Children of Iraq. In this hard-hitting special report, Pilger investigates the effects of sanctions on the people of Iraq and finds that more than 10 years of extraordinary isolation imposed by the UN and enforced by the US and Britain have killed more people than the two atomic bombs dropped on Japan. In the film, Pilger travels with Dennis Halliday, the former Assistant Secretary General of the UN, who resigned over what he called the immoral policy of economic sanctions. The film came out several years ago, but in understanding the history and the isolation and the destruction of Iraq, we felt it was instructive to replay parts of it for you today. Paying the Price. Let's take a listen.
On August the 2nd, 1990, after a dispute over shared oil fields, Iraq invaded Kuwait. 4 days later, the United Nations Security Council imposed economic sanctions, the most comprehensive in modern history. Almost everything was denied the people of Iraq, including, for the first 8 months, food and medicine. Today, 10 years later, sanctions are still in place, and the United Nations reports widespread chronic malnutrition and death among young children, an unprecedented human rights disaster. What happens when modern civilized life is taken away? Imagine all the things we take for granted are suddenly not available or severely limited. Clean water, fresh food, soap, paper, pencils, books, light bulbs, life-saving drugs. Telephone calls to the outside world are extremely difficult. Computers no longer work. When you fall ill, you must sell your furniture to buy medicine. When you have a tooth out, there's no anesthetic. No country will trade with yours, and your money is almost worthless. Soon your children become beggars. It's as if the world has condemned your whole society to a slow death, and all because of a dispute between governments over which you have no control. That's what has happened here in Iraq, where almost 10 years of extraordinary isolation, imposed by the UN and enforced by America and Britain, have killed more people than the two atomic bombs dropped on Japan, including 500,000 young children.
These are the children the West has forgotten. 10 years ago, Iraq was a developed country whose oil had brought great wealth, but also a dependency on imported food and other essentials. Today, the death rate of children under five is over 4,000 every month. That's 4,000 more than would have died before sanctions. This is a typical hospital ward, which sanctions have denied basic equipment and the kind of life-saving drugs available in any British hospital.
Ali Rafa Aswadi, 9 years old,
yes.
Present to us with a progressive pallor and
leukemia.
Now we just start treatment. Some of the drugs is not available, not all the drugs is available. We give a blood transfusion. I tell you before, there is no blood bags enough.
Do you get these drugs some of the time?
Some of the time, for 2-3 weeks, and then stop. No drugs.
So you can't continue a course of
drugs?
We
couldn't continue a course of treatment. Mm. There's interrupted treatment, and sometimes there's no treatment at all. Case of neuroblastoma.
And that's a very unusual tumor.
This is, before we don't see this before. Now in these years, we see many cases of neuroblastoma.
You've never seen this?
No, no. Before, there is only one case per 2 years, every 2 years.
Dr. Ali, what will happen to this child?
This is abdominal mass. Operation was done to him, but the tumor not received treatment. The tumor recurs again. So there is relapse. There's recurrence of a tumor, and now we start some of the drugs. Not all the drugs is available.
So his future is uncertain.
Bad. Because there is renal shutdown. He developed renal failure.
The problem with treating cancer is that you've got to give the drugs at the right time in the right sequence, usually over a period of about 6 months. Monthly visits, maybe 2 weekly visits. Now, with cancer, you only get one bite at the cherry. In other words, if you give them the right sequence at the right time, you have a high chance of curing a range of tumours, including those in children. If you do it wrongly, give them at the wrong time, so even though you have all the drugs, but they come at different intervals.
World Health Organization's Professor Sikora.
You don't get nearly such a high success rate. So an 80% cure rate is translated into a 30% cure rate. Same drugs given in the wrong sequence.
Also neuroblastoma.
This is this unusual malignancy on the nervous system.
Yes.
Which you've only seen now.
Yes, we see many cases now.
Many cases now.
Before we see only one case or two cases every 2-3 years. Now we see many cases. 11 years old, this. Also, look.
She's malnourished.
We start treatment today with available drugs. And some of the drugs is missed. VM26 is not available.
Yeah. Are there many children who never come to hospital?
Many children. Because a very poor family, and we couldn't get this paying for treat the children. Yes, Kalum Saleh. 5.5 years old. Mm-hmm. This is case of Hodgkin's. This also newly diagnosed. Some of the drugs is not available.
So a child with Hodgkin's disease can expect to live?
Live and about improvement 95%. 95% cure. Ah. But if the drug is not available, maybe lead to the other complication. Case malnourished with leukemia, newly diagnosed leukemia, acute lymphoblastic leukemia. Also, you see very poor family. We start treatment by medication, available medication, and some of the drugs is missing for treatment. Thiaguanine is not available. You look, most of the children is malnourished.
And this child is how old?
2 years old.
Two. We've just been around this ward. All these children have a very, very uncertain future. How do you feel about that?
I am very sad. But all of the children look like our daughter or my son. And when you see my son in front of me dying, what happened to you?
This is the Security Council, center of power at the United Nations in New York. In 1996, the Council allowed Iraq to sell some of its oil reserves in order to buy food and other basic needs. This is known as oil for food. All the money from the sale of Iraq's oil is controlled by the Security Council, which the United States dominates, and with Britain, takes a hard line on Iraq. Everything that goes to Iraq must be approved by a special sanctions committee run by the Council. This committee has consistently blocked the restoration of basic services in Iraq, power, light, and clean running water. For the children of Iraq, oil means food. Although the Iraqis have been told they can repair their damaged oil industry, contracts for vital equipment have been blocked or delayed in New York. Currently, more than $1.5 billion worth of desperately needed shipments are on hold, including food, life-saving medical equipment, such as equipment to diagnose and treat cancer, and X-ray machines, heart and lung machines, firefighting equipment, agricultural equipment, and toilet soap. The stated aim of the sanctions is to eradicate Iraq's weapons of mass destruction. Just before last Christmas, the Department of Trade and Industry in London blocked a shipment of vaccines intended to protect Iraqi children against yellow fever and diphtheria. The vaccines, said the minister, are capable of being used in weapons of mass destruction. This is Dennis Halliday, former Assistant Secretary General of the United Nations, the man in charge of the humanitarian operation in Iraq. In 1998, he resigned, accusing the West of destroying a whole society. We took him on his first trip back. In the cancer clinic of this hospital in Baghdad, he had a remarkable reunion with a young girl whose life he helped to save.
John, this is Safa Majid and her father, who is Majid Ali. Safa I met 2 years ago in this hospital when she was in very poor condition of leukemia. And one cannot deal with thousands, but one can deal with one or two or three or four.
Dennis
children.
Halliday.
And I was able, with the help of the World Health Organization, to bring in drugs, although be it illegally, from overseas, enough for 2 years of treatment for this little girl. And today she looks wonderful and beautiful, and she has only now treatment once every month. So I think she's almost cured of leukemia.
She is one of four, wasn't she?
One of four.
Tell me about the others.
Well, within the first 5 weeks of meeting these four children, two died simply for lack of medications, or it was too late, in fact, to save their lives. And there were two little girls, including Safa, who have survived.
Why did they die?
They died because they had sophisticated problems, which the medications were not available.
And when you set out to help these children, you were the United Nations representative here.
That's right.
And to do it, what you're saying is you had to act illegally.
I had to breach my own economic sanctions, so to speak, established by the Security Council, as we know, led by Washington and by London. I think in this hospital we've seen today evidence of the killing that is now the responsibility of the Security Council member states, particularly, I think, Bill Clinton and Tony Blair. They should be here with us. They should see the impact of what their decisions and their sustaining of economic sanctions means. The very provisions of the Charter and the Declaration of Human Rights have been set aside. And we are waging a warfare through the United Nations on the children and people of Iraq with incredible results, results that you do not expect to see in a war under the Geneva Conventions. We're targeting civilians, worse, we're targeting children like Safa, who, of course, were not born when Iraq went into Kuwait. I mean, what is this about? It's a monstrous situation for the United Nations, for the Western world, for all of us who are part of some democratic system, who are, in fact, responsible for the policies of our governments and the implementation of economic sanctions on Iraq.
When the U.S. Secretary of State, Madeleine Albright, was asked on American television if she thought the death of more than 500,000 children was a price worth paying, she replied, "We think the price is worth it."
We don't accept the 500,000 figure. So if you say that Secretary Albright said, "Oh, a half
former
a
State Department spokesperson James Rubin,"
we don't accept this.
The World Health Organization.
I understand that's their figure, and it's derived by a methodology that we don't accept. We do accept the idea that in choosing, in making policy, one has to choose usually between two bad choices, not between a good choice and a bad choice. And unfortunately, the effect of sanctions has been more than we would have hoped. What we've tried to do is to limit that effect, as I indicated, through the Oil for Food and other programs to try to provide food and medicine for the people of Iraq. And so, yes, when Secretary Albright was talking about the hard choice, she was acknowledging the hard choice between the effect of sanctions and the idea of letting Saddam Hussein run rampant, but she wasn't accepting the 500,000 figure.
How many children do you think
have
died?
We don't have a figure. It's not something that one can easily make, and we think some of the people who put these figures out inevitably have to use some dubious methodology.
While Western politicians quibble about methodology, the latest United Nations study says that the death rate of children has doubled under sanctions. That's 500,000 dead in 8 years.
Hassan Rashid, 18 months old, it's before disease, it's after the disease, a case of neuroblastoma in 1993. The child died also because there's no drugs at all. Ali Assad, this is also a case of Hodgkin disease in 1998. He finished treatment. Some of the drugs brings by the family, and he is cured now.
So if you are rich, it's likely you live, and if you are poor...
this die. If the drugs is not available in hospitals, and the family is very poor, the child, he will die soon or later, I thought that.
How do you cope with this work?
Very hardly.
I asked that because I saw you in the corridor there. You'd broken into tears.
Yes. Everything is devastating to us. It's frustrating me because I face many problems and I couldn't do anything. And what happened in the future? All these children is generation of the future. We lost the generation. I want to tell you some things. What the crime the Iraqi children were done to receive this punishment?
What crime?
What a crime.
In Baghdad, what foreigners don't see are well-stocked clinics where Saddam Hussein and his rich cronies get first-class treatment, an indication that sanctions have not hurt them in the slightest.
Why should the civilian population, including children born since the Gulf War, innocent people, be held hostage to the compliance of a dictator?
UN Sanctions
think,
Committee Ambassador Peter Van Walsum.
It is a difficult problem, but you have to think of one thing. Sanctions, a sanction regime, is not a form of development aid. Sanctions are part...
Excuse me, is that... Are you serious in saying
I'm
that?
I'm serious.
I would think it's the very opposite, isn't it?
Well, no, this is exactly my point. You should realize what sanctions are. Mm. And sanctions are one of the coercive measures that the Security Council has at its disposal under Chapter 7. That is to say, it is part of this whole range of measures, starting from declaration to the press, resolution. Then in the end, at the very end of that scale, you will have the military action. Sanctions are the measure just short of military action. And obviously, they hurt. They are like a military measure. They're like a military action.
But who do they hurt?
This is, of course, the problem.
Who they hurt.
With military action, too, you have the eternal problem of collateral damage.
You have an entire nation that has collateral damage here. Forgive me for interrupting, but let me just say this. Every UN agency dealing with health, food, agriculture and children have reported repeatedly the tens of thousands of the most vulnerable in the society have died and are suffering as a result of sanctions. And do you seriously call that collateral damage?
No, I didn't call it collateral damage.
Well, you were drawing a comparison there.
No, I'm saying that military action has collateral damage. Sanctions are short of military action, but they also have, of course, effects that one doesn't want. And I agree with you that we have to study this further and more extensively to see how we can improve the situation without letting the regime off the hook with regard to the excessive documented interest of the government of Iraq for weapons of mass destruction.
Well, why aren't there sanctions on Israel, which has the only nuclear weapons in the Middle East?
Well, Israel is a country that has been surrounded by countries that try to wipe it out. It's not exactly the same situation.
But it has nuclear weapons.
Well, yes, but we have not yet attacked or put sanctions on every country that...
It attacks Lebanon almost every day of the week. I think these are important. Why aren't there sanctions on Turkey, which has displaced something like 3 million Kurds and caused the deaths of perhaps 30,000 Kurds? Why aren't there sanctions on Turkey?
Yeah. Well, there are many countries that do things that we are not happy with, but this is a situation which has come into being due to the invasion of Kuwait, and that is the explanation of it.
This is Dr. Jawad Al-Ali, a cancer specialist and member of Britain's Royal College of Physicians.
And this is our chest X-ray. It shows the nodules. All the lungs are filled with nodules from the cancer of the breast. I don't think we can help her anymore. We just support her. We treat the chest infection, treat the anemia by blood transfusion, and we will wait until she will end her life. Really, we have problem because the complaints of pain, which is a very severe pain, unrelieved by simple analgesics or painkillers. They need probably morphia. And these drugs are not available. Morphia is not available.
One of the drugs that really seemed crazy that they couldn't have was morphine, the best and oldest pain control medicine in the world, and often called God's own drug, because for everybody that has cancer pain, it is the best drug. And yet they didn't have morphine. They had very little analgesics. The cancer centre, when I was there, had a little bottle of aspirin pills, and yet 200 patients are in there, many of them in pain, with a bottle of aspirin to go round them. So it seemed a very bizarre situation.
Do you believe that people have human rights, no matter where they live and under what system they live, that the human rights belong to the individual?
Yes.
Well. Doesn't that, if you apply that to Iraq, don't then the effects that these sanctions are had, documented by the UN itself, aren't they violating the human rights of literally millions of people?
The human rights in Iraq are a very difficult subject. It is also documented in the United Nations that the regime has committed very serious human rights.
No
you're,
doubt about
you're
that.
Aware of that.
Of course.
Yeah. So I think we are constantly concerned about human rights one way or the other. It's
but they're no different.
Issue.
You said they're a very difficult subject, but to an ordinary Iraqi, human rights belong to them. This is you would agree with that, regardless of the fact that they've been lucky or unlucky to have been born in Iraq. Doesn't hurting them violate those human rights?
Yes, but obviously this is exactly why I say that we do not want to hurt the population of Iraq, and this is why we are trying to improve the system.
Yeah. Okay. The numbers of children, 4,000 under fives dying every month. Terrible figures. This has been known for years. Why is it taking so long to deliberate on how to get over this so-called complex issue?
I think we could have solved the matter fairly easily if all members of the Security Council were determined to improve that situation, but at the same time make sure that there are guarantees that Iraq will not again develop weapons of mass destruction. The fact that the major powers disagree on that makes it extremely difficult to solve the situation.
We are now in the process, through the Security Council, of destroying the human rights of the Iraqi people. And for many of us, that is an extraordinary situation, where the chamber responsible for peace and security is neglecting the very provisions of the Charter, which forms the basis of the organization itself. It's an extraordinary phenomenon. There is no democracy in the Security Council. I think if the issue of sanctions on Iraq, after 9 long years, were to go to the General Assembly, we'd see a very large majority overturning those sanctions tomorrow.
On February the 13th, this man resigned his job. Hans von Sponeck, the senior United Nations representative in Iraq, followed his predecessor, Dennis Halliday, saying he could no longer tolerate the suffering caused by sanctions.
I do not think it is fair for such a long period of time to make a civilian population a subject to bargaining. And what we are seeing here is too often exactly that.
Paying the Price, Killing the Children of Iraq, is a documentary by the filmmaker John Pilger. It is distributed in the United States by Bullfrog Films. Those are just excerpts. You can go to our website for more information at www.democracynow.org. Our email address is mail, M-A-I-L, at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen, Anna Noguera, and Alex Wolf. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. That special thanks to Uri Galed and Angela Alston, Emily Kunstler and Johnny Sender. Also to Karen Ranucci and Dennis Moynihan and Fatima Mojadidi, Simba Russo and Orlando Richards. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Democracy Now!